Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Simon Barrett, and this is another in my ongoing series, The Week in Reviews, a chance to sit down one-on-one with someone in the entertainment world. My guest today really needs no introduction. He is a well-known musician in his own right, and his father was an absolute icon of rock music for decades, Frank Zappa. It is my great pleasure to talk to Dweezil Zappa. Dweezil, hello. Hello, Dweezil. Hi. For some unknown reason, the switchboard decided to mute you. Dweezil, I do hope you were... Right. Yeah, that's technology at work. Dweezil, welcome to the program.
Yes, thank you very much.
So, my research says that you were born in 1969. Now, I have to admit that in my book, that makes you a bit of a youngster. But, you know, how was it growing up as Frank Zappa's son?
Well, I think a lot of people have some idea that our house must have been crazy, filled with all kinds of distractions and people that were doing weird things and on drugs or weird behaviors that were not supposed to be around kids and all that kind of stuff. But that just never happened. You know, I have two sisters and a brother, and none of us ever got involved in any of the crazy things that you hear about lots of Hollywood families. You know, I mean, most of the Hollywood families you hear about, the kids go through rehab three times before they're 30. And, you know, none of us ever got involved in drugs or alcohol, and that stuff just wasn't around. I've never taken a drug or have been drunk or any of those things my entire life. So quite the opposite of what people expect when they think, oh, yeah, let me hear about that crazy childhood of yours. But the reality is that my dad was a very serious musician, and when he was at work, he worked from home. When he wasn't touring, he was at home working in the studio and writing music, and both of our parents were home, working from home. So we actually had a different situation than a lot of other kids growing up. You know, both parents were accessible and at home because they worked from home, and we had a pretty normal existence, just that, you know, my dad made music, you know, as his job, as opposed to being a postman.
Right. You know, it is one of the things that I find humorous. You know, I'll talk to someone, and the subject of Frank Zappa comes up, and he was high on everything known to man, and yet, you know, everything I've read says that, you know, he wasn't like that at all. Yeah,
yeah, indeed, that's the case. He was always outspoken against people doing drugs. Even in his movie Baby Snakes, you can see him telling audience members who are clearly on drugs and offering drugs to other people, offering drugs to him from the stage, he's saying no, and he's saying that stuff's bad for you, you shouldn't do it. And, you know, it's amazing that people would like to try to rewrite history for their own interpretation to keep perpetuating some myth that he was the crazy guy that was only creative because of drugs or whatever. So, I mean, even a couple years ago, Rolling Stone printed an illustration of Frank holding a joint, And it was just so inappropriate and irresponsible for them to do that. Not exactly a surprise from such a publication, but in any case, it's still, you know, it's one of those things that the media tries to proliferate instead of set it straight.
Did you feel pressure at home to become a musician?
No, there was no pressure on any of us to do anything in the music business or entertainment business. But because we were around it and we grew up with a sense of artistic freedom to pursue those kind of ideas, it certainly seemed appealing. You know, my dad was always telling us that it's really not the best industry to get into because it really isn't based on talent or skill. It's a business that's, you know, going to be filled with compromises and disappointments if you're really going to try to base everything you do on the level of skill or talent. I mean, look at my dad's music as an example. The kind of skills he acquired as a composer, as a guitarist, as a band leader, all those things, many of them have gone unnoticed and unrecognized for years and years and years. And the things that he did were far, you know, head and shoulders above the other average things that were out there. And his intention with music was to make music that he liked, and if other people liked it, that was great. But when he started, there was a whole different way that the music industry worked, and you could still make money from music publishing and album sales and all that kind of stuff. So in this digital world we live in, that really just doesn't happen, except for the biggest acts in the world. They can still sell some records and make some publishing money on it, but otherwise people just assume you're supposed to give your audience your music for free. It's been so devalued that people don't care about it. So anyway, you know, your question was, did I feel pressure to become a musician? No, it felt like something I wanted to do, but I went into it knowing that it wasn't going to be the easiest road.
You you mentioned that you had a brother and two sisters. Are they also involved in the music world?
Not professionally. They do certain things here or there. My brother has worked with me in the past. We've made a couple records together and have done some touring, but he's not really involved in music at this point. My sister Moon did a song with my dad called Valley Girl that was very popular. And that was kind of a fluke that it became such a popular song. And one of the things about that is that the music that has found its way onto the radio of my father's has always been music that is, some people would describe it as novelty music because it has a bit of a comedic slant to it. So a song like Valley Girl or a song like Don't Eat the Yellow Snow, those things got on the radio and they're story songs and they have some humor. But people tend to just think, oh, yeah, he's the guy with the wacky kids' names and the wacky song names and the wacky name himself, and they just sort of dismiss the music straight off the bat. When he made over 80 albums, and the majority of the stuff on the record is nothing like the quote-unquote novelty music people describe. You know, he made very serious music with very serious modern classical compositions and very sophisticated rhythm and harmonic content to these songs. So to me, I felt like I wanted to make sure that future generations got a chance to be exposed to the music and let the music speak for itself. And that's how I ended up doing Zappa Plays Zappa. I just realized there were people that were younger than me that had no idea. If you mentioned the name Frank Zappa, they would say, who? And I just didn't think that was a good thing.
You know, I find that amusing. But there again, I'm old. You know, I know exactly who Frank Zappa is.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, the reality is anything can become popular if it gets enough exposure, but, you know, how do you get exposure for a great artist's work who, you know, is not out there physically producing new material and able to promote it themselves, you know? So there's not, like, this massive machine that is promoting this thing. We do a grassroots level tour, and we go out to different cities across the world, and we play the music. And we've seen since 2006 that the age range of the audience has come way down. You know, it used to be that the people that would attend the first shows that we did were all 65 and older, and mostly men, you know, very few women. But these days we see a lot more college-age kids and younger kids coming with their parents, a lot more women. So what we've been doing has spread the message and give people given people an opportunity to have this music apply to, you know, their daily lives now. Instead of it being regarded as nostalgia music or novelty music, you know, Frank's music, I think, is still very much from the future, and it's still yet to be fully discovered and recognized for what's in it. And we just give people the opportunity to hear it in a live situation, because that is probably the best way for people to, you know, get a real feel for it and understand and appreciate what it takes to play it.
You've mentioned the term novelty music twice, and I guess you're right. You know, there are a couple of his songs that, you know, might be viewed that way, but I have never ever thought of Frank's work as novelty stuff. I mean, he has a huge catalog. I don't know exactly how many songs. In fact, I doubt you do. Or maybe
you
do.
No, I don't. I mean, you know, in the releases that have come out even since he's passed, you know, we're over 100 records that are in the, you know, in release. And so even if you went and said that there were 10 songs on every record, some songs may have that, some songs may have less, some songs may have, some albums may have more than 10. You know, you're still, you can't get an exact accurate number on all of the songs, but there's a lot of material out there, and like I was saying, the casual exposure that people may have had for songs like Valley Girl or Don't Eat the Yellow Snow, the things that got the most radio airplay, those don't represent the majority of the catalog. So it's a bit of a tricky situation, because if you're talking about people that get a first impression from hearing it on the radio, what the impression that they're getting is not accurate to, you know, the full picture of the full catalog.
Right. And I'll tell you what. Why don't we listen to part of your catalog? You have a CD, Go With What You Know, which I think is a delightful title. Would you mind if I was to play Peaches in Regalia?
Yeah, we could. The one thing that's special about this version is that I was able to do a duet with my father. So what I did was I played along with the actual master tape recording of the Hot Rats album version of Peaches on Regalia. Now, that song, that record, the Hot Rats album, was dedicated to me because it came out the year that I was born. And so that particular song was always a favorite of mine. And what I did was I learned all of the parts that were played on organ and some of the saxophone and woodwind lines, and I played those parts on guitar for this version, replacing those textures with guitar textures. And then I also doubled Frank's actual guitar solo, so he's on the left and I'm on the right, playing in unison. But this version also allows the listener to hear some things that weren't on the original release. In fact, there's a little bass solo that Frank plays, and that is featured on this version. And you can also hear Frank talking at the beginning of the track and at the end of the track, so you actually hear what was happening before the recording took place. So there's an interesting combination of different generations happening all at once on this version.
Okay, well, here it is.
Get that groove going.
That's just a great track, and it kind of ruins my next question, because I think I already know the answer. Your father loved the Sinclair, and I'm guessing that we do have the Sinclair in there, in that, you know, you used his original track and overlaid it.
No, the Sinclair wasn't used for it. That that device was a compositional device that used computer programming to output the notes that he put in there, and it could play live samples, things that he recorded in his studio. But I just used analog master tapes, and I used a computer recording setup called Nuendo, which is similar to Pro Tools, but just sounds better to me. And I added my guitar overdubs to it, and I mixed it, and there it is. The thing that you hear at the beginning, the very beginning, is backwards acoustic guitar that has then been messed with the EQ, so it doesn't sound like backwards acoustic guitar, but it plays the intro melody in sort of this haunting backwards way, and it comes back halfway through the song that way as well. So few modern textures added to it, but mostly it's what it was from 1969.
I love the backwards idea at the very beginning, and it is. You know, I've heard it done before, and you know, it's just a technique that sticks in your mind.
Well, in the case of that, you know, what it can do for an acoustic guitar is it can recreate the sound of a bowed instrument, because the envelope swell of the backwards nature of it is. It's very similar when you hear that backwards, just because the initial attack of an acoustic guitar is not unlike a piano. So it has a very sharp initial attack, and then the waveform slowly subsides. But when you have it go backwards, it has this smooth attack, and then it has a sharp release. So it makes for an interesting crescendo type of sound.
Okay, let's come back to your upcoming tour.
Sure.
Personally, I love the concept of Zappa Plays Zappa. What better title could you have? You find yourself in a very unique position, a tribute band, but a very unique tribute band. I think the nearest I can come up with is Oliver Wakeman. You know, he toured with the Straubs and flirted with Yes, you know, when Rick was being a little grumpy. But you're doing something very different. I think it's quite wonderful that, you know, you're doing this for your father. The question is, why?
Well, I talked about it a little bit earlier when we started talking, but the thing is, there is so much that he created in the world of music, not only just the notes that were recorded, but he pioneered a lot of recording techniques. He pioneered a lot of things having to do with live sound, in terms of making a live concert sound better, sound reinforcement, speaker design, all kinds of stuff. So his accomplishments, I felt, were really not being fully discussed discovered by the upcoming generation. So when, you know, like I said, if there are people under 30, you mentioned the name Frank Zappa, many of them, in fact, the majority of them would say, who? So to me, I just, in my lifetime, I thought that was a bad trend to see happening. I'd like his music to be better understood and more appreciated for what it really is, and again, not for the novelty aspect of it. So it seemed to me that there should be an attempt made to have his music be put in front of an audience in a respectful demonstration of the music that lets the music speak for itself. So that really that's the thing that's being delivered. It's not about showing or paying any attention to individual people in the band. It's an ensemble that's performing the music of Frank Zappa. So, you know, me as the band leader, I wanted to make sure that people were able to discover the music in a way that de-emphasized what was being programmed in people's minds, which was this sort of idea that it was novelty music, or at this point, nostalgia novelty music, because that's the thing that you're up against. You know, here's a lifelong career of amazing music that people think, oh, it's only for the past generations, and it's not current, it's not modern. Well, if you're unfamiliar with it, you can't really say that, you know. So when you listen to it and you see how ahead of its time it is, then you can be better, you know, educated as to what he really did accomplish. And so our goal was just to create a situation that allowed people to hear the music in a live setting that really respectfully paid attention to the details in the music. And what I mean by that is Frank was a composer. He wrote his music on paper. He was very, very skilled at writing music notation. And he went to school. I mean, he went to the library, and he didn't go to music school. He went to the library to teach himself how to do all of these techniques that composers do. He wanted to be a composer when he was 11 years old, and he set out to do that. And really, what we have are the scores, the music on the page, and we follow the directions of the music on the page. And where we don't have the scores, we diligently make transcriptions from the recordings that we have, and we go as far as taking the master tapes out of the tape vault and listening to the individual tracks and transcribing those so that we're getting the exact notes that are played for the recordings, because that is what the music is supposed to sound like. We don't try to reinterpret it or try to make it something that it's not. You know, a lot of people say, oh, well, the way to get a new audience to appreciate Frank's music, you got to modernize it. You got to put all these different synthesizers on it. You have to get some guy to come rap over it. And, you know, that just doesn't sound very appealing to me because, you know, for example, Beethoven's music is still well known by a lot of people because they play it as it is on the page. You don't have classical concerts happening where you get some MC guy out going, yeah, Beethoven in the house, yeah. You don't need that to make it appeal to a new generation, you know.
Well, one thing that you mentioned that I personally was not aware of, your father was involved with some hardware development, you know, amps and speakers?
Yeah, throughout his career, you know, he was very much interested in the science of sound and very much, he was very knowledgeable about how sound worked and what was the best way to capture it on a record. So he was always interested in pushing music technology in the best possible way. In fact, in his book, the real Frank Zappa book, towards the very end of the book, you can see that he applied for a patent on a music delivery device, which is essentially iTunes, you know, and he applied for this back in like 1979, 1980. But really what it was a delivery system, a digital delivery system that was intended to use the phone lines at that time, but the reason it didn't work was that there was something called the baud rate, which wouldn't allow for the transfer of the music delivery system, couldn't actually provide the actual wave file style audio. You know, we ended up, all of us in this day and age, getting used to the sound of MP3s, which are these degraded versions of audio. So he was trying to avoid that from the get-go and have the full bandwidth of the audio, and at the time the technology wouldn't support it. But you know, that's he was involved in all kinds of things, you know, like I said, the sound reinforcement, speaker design, those kinds of things. From touring, he said, well, why don't we build a our own monitor system, and let's put these kind of speakers in it, and let's have them, you know, work this way. He needed sound to be dispersed on the stage in a specific way, and there weren't speaker boxes designed to do what he wanted. So, you know, he spoke with different people and got things built, custom made the way he wanted, and you know, that was the kind of person that he was. It wasn't just about the notes on the page. It was about the whole experience for the listener, giving them a chance to hear the music the absolute best quality possible. And you can hear that, the sound quality of his recordings and the live shows. They were always incredibly well mixed, and much of his catalog is live recorded music, and it sounds as if it was recorded in the studio, because he was so careful to use the right equipment and operate a band using the right dynamics.
Dweezil, I do hope that you have time. I'm thinking that we should probably play another track from your very excellent CD, and
sure.
I'm thinking about the Rhythmist.
The Rhythmist, yep.
Yeah.
That song is a an instrumental of mine that has, on this recording, has a few different textures. I did some MIDI programming to include instruments that I couldn't physically play, so you'll hear marimba and some violin and some other little textures that come in there periodically, but there's acoustic guitars and electric guitars, and it's kind of a bit of a crazy tune.
Okay, well, here it is. yet another very fine track. I mean, you certainly have the gift. You know how to create music.
Well, thank you.
Were it not for a good friend of mine, we would not be talking. So I have to give a shout out to the guy I like to call the Energizer Bunny, Charlie Boswell. What is it like, dealing with Charlie face to face?
Well, Charlie is a very interesting guy, and he's involved in a lot of different technology things. I started working with him when he was working at a company called AMD, but he's gone on to do his own companies and other things. So he's always been a big supporter of Zappa Plays Zappa, and he's a guitar player as well. So we've played together and have fun working on various different projects where he's even been responsible for filming things, So he makes DVD content and all kinds of stuff. Very interesting, clever guy. And he's always been a great supporter of the project and always fun to be around.
I love Charlie. But, I find that a 10-minute phone call with Charlie, I'm ready for a nap.
Yeah, well, he's certainly involved in a lot of things.
Right. So let's go back to your big tour.
Sure.
I know we're running way over time, but I got to ask you, where are you going to be playing? I know you're going to be starting in the U.S., but then you're going to be heading elsewhere.
Yeah. Each year we've been doing this since 2006. We've gone to certain special enclaves in the U.S. and Canada and Europe, and sometimes we get to vary that up a bit, but it's the same kind of scenario. We go wherever we can find people wanting us to come play, and we will definitely be in the U.S. and all over Canada and several places in Europe, including Estonia and Finland this time around. But we always play several shows in the U.K. and Scandinavia, and so we'll be doing that again. We'll be out there quite a bit. It'll be 2013 and 2014 that we'll be doing this 40-year anniversary Roxy album tour. And on this particular tour in venues in the U.S. and Canada, I'm also doing a thing where I will be doing a pre-soundcheck guitar class for people that sign up and come down to participate. It's sort of an hour-long thing where I answer questions and do demonstrations of certain things that people have been writing to me about or been interested in. And so it's a way to answer these questions for people and help them learn some stuff that I put to use on the guitar.
It sounds like it's an incredibly busy schedule.
It is.
Right. Don't you, sometimes wish, oh, go away. I just want to go home. I don't want to sleep in another hotel bed. I don't want another restaurant meal.
Well, more than that, it's time away from my kids, So I would definitely prefer to have a schedule that would keep me actually home in town more frequently. But you know, as this project is what it is, you know, we have a certain way that it has to be done, and for the life of the project, that's just kind of what it is, you know.
And one last question for you. We've got to do some shameless commercialization. Now, where can people find you? Do you have a website, Facebook?
Yeah, the easiest place to find me is at my website, which is my name, Dweezil Zappa, but it's DweezilZappaWorld.com. And, you know, there's a Facebook page and there's all those things. But the tour dates and videos and all kinds of content are on the Dweezil Zappa World .com site, and people should come check it out.
And I will certainly make a point of that, you know, in my you know, article. Dweezil, I really want to thank you for taking time out of your day to talk to me. I'm sure that you thought, and this is going to be one of those five-minute interviews, and I'm looking at the clock. It's 45 minutes.
Well, you know, it's a nice place to get the word out, and, you know, I'm happy to have the opportunity. But now I have to go back and practice the bebop tango, so.
Dweezil, you have yourself a wonderful day, and good luck with the new tour.
Thanks very much. Talk to you soon.
Okay, bye.
All right, thanks. Bye-bye.